the way she had fallen asleep with a stick in her hand, not once or twice, but 100 times, reviewing moves in her head. She'd been through a stretch at Iowa when she had not spent even a single holiday with her family, a period in which Thanksgiving to her only meant prep time for the NCAAs and Christmas the A camp in New Jersey, when even the 4th of July was lost to the National Futures Tournament, and in which the time devoted to sport meant it took 6 years for her B.A. Field hockey became a tunnel in her life, a long passage in which there was little external light. When it was suddenly over, she was like some underworld person returned to daytime, blinded, dazzled. But beyond detailing her devotion, she could not share an answer to his questions. She was just not as open, or sloppy, choose the word, as he was. She could never take the joy or comfort he seemed to find in revealing himself. It had just been the path that was clear to her. Her father had been a baseball star, and it turned out his ability had leaped generations like an electrical arc. Even had his power, his surprising speed from such a bandy build, and the precision to make that astonishing triangulation about where a flying ball, her body, and her stick were going to arrive. In the game, with the moving hand of the clock feeling as if it were winding her heart tighter, with the dimension of the known universe shrunk to 100 yards by 60, and its population reduced to the other 21 women on the field, with grace and fury possessing her as if they were visiting from somewhere else, at those moments she was finally, fully herself, not the odd, unknown, scowling girl lost in her tumbling home. Her father lit up like a lantern when she played, paced the side, at times too stirred up to watch, but her mother never really seemed to care for the sight of her, even when she ran from the field in victory. Her hair clung in damp ringlets to her cheeks, her uniform was mud-spotted, and her knee pads and socks were dragging down. Often at the end of the game she could see that she was where she had started, odd and vaguely unwelcome. Not simply because she was a girl, good at what many still thought was reserved for boys, but because in her passion, in the explosive, furious way she crossed the field, she was revealing something about herself, much like her scowling, which others did not want to know. "I had the talent," she said, "and I worked it, for whatever that was worth." She shrugged, unwilling to express much more. The Mercedes by now had glided to a halt in front of the awning and the handsome refinished doors at her building. "How far did you get? The team? Did you guys get close to a medal?" She waved a hand, barring further inquiry. She heard her mother's corrosive warnings about being boastful and showy, and she was still wary on principle about going too far too fast. But neither concern was the real problem. "I did my best, Robbie, but it's over now. I've had to let it go." The streets glistened in the warmth of a night thaw that would bring fog by morning. In the reflected light she could see the fixed way he watched her. He knew about that, she realized, letting loose of the grandest hopes. Loss freighted his expression. "Yeah," he said. He took quite some time before he spoke again. "If I said, 'Let me buy you dinner,' that wouldn't be right, would it?" "Would it?" She sighed on reflex, weighing it. But it was still too chancy. He was dashed, of course. "Well, okay," he answered, but was too raw to look her way for long. His hurt, like almost everything else, was so open. "What the hell," she thought. "What the hay?" "We took a bronze," she said.
"No way! Really?"
She indulged them both by absorbing his momentary worship. A medal. An Olympic medal. You could see his heart fly at the thought. She did not surrender often to pride, fearing she could remain stuck there for life. But tonight, under his influence, she felt it fill her out. She had done that, set her mind, scaled the heights, and returned with the vaunted trophy. Ironically, he recognized the cost, too.
That's a lot to climb down from.
It is, she answered. You realize you're a lot later than other people in getting started on a life. They talked another moment. Before she left the car, he held out his hand to shake. Congratulations, probably. Alighting, she had another thought. Peace. Chapter 13.
People talk, Robbie told us, about Brendan, because Kosick and Malaki are always stuck to him like gum on your shoe. You know, it's like, what gives? Especially with Rollo, because Rollo's lived for more than 30 years in the basement apartment of that big stone house of Brendan's out in Latterly on the West Bank, and Rollo's sort of been Brendan's loyal liege his whole life. The story is that they're both from the same parish, but Brendan's a few years older, so they didn't really get hooked up until they ended up in the same platoon in Korea. Anyway, they're in the same hellacious firefight, charging up Pork Chop Hill or wherever. The commies are kicking their living ass, and Brendan looks around, and some chink jumps out of a bush and just about empties his rifle in Rollo. When they tell the story, and I've heard it about 700 or 800 times, it's like in the movies where the guy sort of stands there raffling from the bullets, dead already, and only the recoil keeping him on his feet. Rollo's ripped to shreds, but good, brave Brendan, under no circumstances will he say quit. He throws Rollo over his back and carries him up the hill for half an hour until he gets him to a corpsman. And this, by the way, is not just a story. Brendan's got the Silver Star at home to prove it. Robbie paused to direct a look across the conference room table at Senate, a warning that Brendan Toohey would risk his life to defy his enemies. Anyway, when Rollo recovers, he's like some character in an old novel or the Book of Ruth. My life is yours, whither thou goest. I don't know exactly what he pledged, but he's had his nose in Brendan's hind end ever since. Brendan becomes a cop, Rollo becomes a cop. Brendan becomes a deputy PA, Rollo gets assigned to the PA's investigation unit. Brendan becomes a judge, and pretty soon Rollo's the bailiff in Brendan's courtroom.
Given the living arrangements, Robbie said, there was occasional sniggering. But his bet was what you saw was what you got. Two crusty old bachelors, farting and walking around in their underwear. For one thing, Robbie said, Brendan had a thing on the side, his secretary, Constanza, for more than 20 years now. Constanza was married, which suited Brendan just fine. He had once told Robbie he would no more care to live with a woman than with a parrot. Love the plumage, he said, but too much jabber. Easier this way. Indeed, in one of his acidic, if antic, moods, Robbie told us too he had delivered a fairly entertaining monologue about why liquor was a more dependable companion than a woman. Kosick, who said almost nothing to anyone, seemed to share these attitudes. He too had a girlfriend, a widow, his second cousin, whom, conveniently, he could never marry. In Robbie's opinion, the motive for Kosick's and Toohey's living arrangements was not sex, but money. Brendan had extended Kosick's duties as bagman far beyond the usual role of a simple intermediary. The rent, as Robbie called it, which certain common law claims judges paid to remain in their courtrooms, was delivered to Kosick and never went farther. For more than a decade, Robbie had never seen Brendan reach into his pocket, even for a quarter, for a newspaper. Kosick handled everything. He paid all the household expenses, the light bill, the phone company, with money orders purchased at random currency exchanges and banks. Brendan had no credit cards and rarely used his checking account. Meals, vacations, clothing, his debts from his card games at Rob Roy, his country club, even the little bit on the side he had always given Constanza, were always handed over by Rollo.
"Forgot my wallet," was the excuse with those who did not know him well. Others did not bother to ask. Occasionally, apropos of nothing, Brendan would mention his mother's depression-learned lessons about the evils of credit and the virtues of hard cash. Robbie had never heard anything similar from Sheila, Mort's mother. It was just Brendan's play, always a step or two ahead of his imagined enemies. This debriefing about Kosick followed Robbie's payoff to Walter by several days. It was occasioned by Wunsch's warning that Robbie couldn't expect a miracle of the month club regarding the three new contrived cases that had landed on Malatesta's docket. From the start, Sennett and McManus had known that there was a finite number of complaints they could file in a short period. Tui's cohort would feel put upon and suspicious if there were too many specials. Mort could become curious about the extraordinary volume of referrals coming upstairs from me, and the judges might grow wary if Robbie and McManus kept showing up as matched opponents like Tracy and Hepburn. On the other hand, Stan was under continuing pressure from D.C. to keep the project moving forward. By now, he'd taken a small coterie of assistant U.S. attorneys into his confidence, never seen by us and rarely mentioned, but whose presence was indicated by the volumes of paperwork forthcoming in connection with each of the new complaints Stan had produced every 10 days or so. But the judicial assignments on the new cases continued to fall out inconveniently. Besides Malatesta, two cases had gone to Gillian Sullivan, who was temporarily unapproachable. At the moment, Judge Sullivan was under intense media scrutiny that resulted from some ridiculous inebriate remarks she'd made to a Hispanic attorney who'd arrived late in her courtroom. Only one case had gone to Sherm Crowthers, who was proceeding with it at his usual phlegmatic pace, and none had been assigned to Barnett Skolnick, the only judge who accepted money from Robbie directly, and the one whom Sennett was dying to bag as a way to quiet the doubters in D.C. When Sennett had suggested trying to transfer a case or two from Malatesta to Skolnick, Robbie had scoffed. "Sure, Stan, I'll just give Rollo Kosick a bang on the phone and tell him the FBI prefers Judge Skolnick." Besides, Robbie pointed out, Kosick was clearly favoring Malatesta at the moment, probably because his docket had been consumed by a lengthy environmental tort case that had limited the business he could do on the side. But now McManus had recognized that an opportunity was presented by Walter's warning that for a while Malatesta wouldn't risk more favorable rulings for favor.
"That's your excuse to talk to Kosick," McManus said, "because you need results on one of these cases right now."
Naturally, Stan was excited by the prospect of breaching Tui's inner circle so soon, but Robbie continued to insist it was impossible.
"I don't do Rollo. I mean, I talk to him. He'd bounce into my usual pop stand now and then, so sometimes I'd buy him a beverage. But Rollo's the kind of guy you hear from him when he wants. I never call him. And no matter what, I don't talk dirty to the guy. I couldn't sell it." "Always act in your own person," Robbie concluded, another quote from Stanislavski.
"Sure you can, Robbie," said McManus soothingly.
Jim had removed his glasses. He did this whenever he became intent, so much so I'd become convinced that the glasses were window panes, merely part of a disguise. Now he extolled Robbie's abilities as an actor and a salesman, and told him there'd be no problem setting up a meeting to appear accidental.
"We have this little thing we do called surveillance," said McManus.
He pointed outside, meant to indicate Joe Amari.
"We'll tail Kosick for a while. When he shows up at your spot, you'll get a call."
Jim had never pushed favor before. He was a model of reason and caution, but he'd clearly noticed what I had in Robbie's quick-eyed resistance, something I hadn't observed in the months I'd been his lawyer. This wasn't a down mood, or even pre-game butterflies. Robbie Favor was flat-out scared. One afternoon in late February, as Robbie and Evan were prepping a client, Heidi Brunswick, for her depth, Bonita put a call through to Robbie. He was sitting in the tall leather chair behind his desk, and as he listened, he did not move. Even assumed Lorraine had taken another bad turn. Instead, he ended by saying, "You're the greatest," and buzzed Bonita to get Mort, who was defending a deposition in the palace. "Let's go," he told Even. Susie, the other paralegal, was summoned to finish with Heidi, and Robbie, with apologies to the client, ran to the door. "New one," he told Even in the elevator. By now, she recognized the look. After nearly 8 weeks in his office, she'd seen favor through major depositions, even one day of a trial that settled after jury selection. Yet nothing excited either Robbie or Mort like the prospect of signing up a new client. They reached a state of high alert as if they'd smelled gunpowder on the air. The fact that Robbie's days in practice were limited and that he could expect a share in the fee on these cases, even from a jail cell, did nothing to lessen his enthusiasm. But for Robbie, charming and landing a new client was a thrill in its own right, a supreme moment of performance, in which success meant he'd persuaded at least one person he was a better lawyer than anyone else in the Tri-Cities. The present matter was what Robbie referred to as a good case, meaning there were prospects for a huge recovery. The would-be client was a 36-year-old mother of three. Yesterday, her doctor had sent her home from his office, telling her that her chest pains were bronchitis. The paramedics had just brought her into Sisters of Mercy's emergency room, unconscious and fibrillating in the aftermath of a major coronary infarct. Even understood enough of the grim alchemy of this practice, in which misfortune was turned into gold, to realize that the damages could escalate dramatically if she died, leaving three motherless children. Favor pushed the Mercedes toward 80 on the highway. He had been tipped on the case by the administrator of the ER. "We were real good friends for a while," Robbie explained. He clearly knew his way around the hospital, slamming the pressure plate on the walls that swept open the doors to the ER with a hydraulic whoosh. His open top coat floated behind him like a cape as he hustled to the administrator's office. The woman was striking, African-American and something else, Polynesian, perhaps. There was a trace of some high-cheeked, ancestral beauty. She was in her mid-30s and carefully put together, wearing a large designer scarf that covered her shoulders and was knotted mid-chest. Robbie kissed her on the cheek. She placed an arm around him in greeting and directed him at once down the corridor into the waiting area for the emergency room. The space was crowded, most of the people in the four rows of plastic chairs evincing the beleaguered, blown-apart look of anxiety so intense it had grown numbing. A bloated young woman with a ratted hairdo in some disarray cradled one child, a newborn, while two more, both boys, near three, climbed around the seats, raising a commotion. She spoke to them harshly, and occasionally flicked out a hand to deliver a swat that each child was already skilled in avoiding. She finally caught one of them, and his howls filled the small area. In spite of the cold, an African-American teen was dressed on top in nothing but a white T-shirt, on which blood had already dried brown. He held one arm with the other. A crude bandage of gauze and tape was visible near his shoulder. An older woman, his mother, Even guessed, sat beside him, humped up in a bulky brown winter coat, tossing her head in chagrin every now and then. The boy, Even took it, had been stabbed. In the very last row were the people Robbie and the administrator, Taylor, were looking for, the family of the woman who was somewhere behind the curtains 100 feet away, struggling for her life. A lumpy-looking younger man with the pallor of a potato and thinning hair appeared to be the husband. He had his hands folded piously and looked completely bewildered. Beside him was an elderly couple, a porky, hard-faced man with black hair and a pack of cigarettes bulging in his shirt pocket, and his wife, whose jaw was already trembling from the strain of prolonged weeping. She cried again as soon as she saw Robbie with Taylor. She could not wait to tell her story. Still in his coat, Robbie slid into the chair beside her and immediately took her hand.
"Robbie fever," he said.
Even was sure he'd pronounced it that way, fever. From a gold case in his suit pocket, he offered his card. By herself, several seats down, sat the oldest child, who perhaps had insisted on coming along. Neatly dressed, she was about 9, with dishwater curls. She'd sunk down in her chair, looking into her lap. She alone seemed to have fully taken on the gravity of the situation, recognizing the emotional abyss over which the entire family now teetered. After a while, Robbie took out his yellow pad and began to write. He followed each of the family members intently as they related the story. About 10 minutes later, Mort arrived with his slow-paced, shuffling limp, and took up the seat between the daughter and her father. He spoke first to the child. He was quiet and made no effort to humor her, but hovered, awaiting her responses. When at last he received a decisive nod, he reached into his briefcase and removed a book of crossword puzzles and a pencil. Mort turned next to the father. The two lawyers were like that, literally enveloping the family from both sides, when a doctor called out, "Rickmeyer, who's with Cynthia Rickmeyer?" He was in operating scrubs, including the green head cover, and he was followed somewhat timidly by two female residents, one also dressed for surgery, the other in a long white coat with a stethoscope at her throat. The surgeon, eager to get this over with, apparently took Robbie and Mort for family members. He motioned them all to an adjoining room and began speaking as soon as he had closed the door. He did not get very far before the old woman let out a primal shriek. Grief drove her to a corner of the room where she looked up to a crucifix above her and cried out expressions that did not quite cross the threshold to words. Her husband cast a puzzled look her way and shook his head. The doctor had continued speaking, and Robbie scratched a few things on the yellow pad beside him, until one of the residents seemed to take note, causing him to lay the pen aside. At that point, he followed the dead woman's mother to the corner and put his arm around her. Mort, in the meantime, had steered the little girl to her father, who, even standing, still clasped his hands. He had said almost nothing, but tears coursed beneath his glasses as his daughter leaned against him. Mort, on the other side, took her hand. He was quietly weeping himself. More startling to even, Robbie, when he returned to the other family members, was weeping too. Real tears leaving trails of light on both cheeks. She never cried. That was another lesson from the playing field. No tears, no matter how bad the blow. Robbie, in time, began talking to the family about arrangements, offering assistance with a funeral home. He motioned to Ivan and gave her a phone number. As she left, she saw him reach into his briefcase for the contract. She knew the form by heart now. "We hereby exclusively retain the firm of Favor and Dinnerstein to represent us." He passed it and the Mont Blanc pen down to the husband, now sitting limply in a chair. His arm was around his daughter, and his eyes were fixed on the large clock. His mother-in-law was demanding he sign. They were going to get the shits who did this to Cynthia. She couldn't leave this place, she said, without knowing the process had begun. When Ivan returned, Robbie was on his feet. His eyes were dry now. His coat was buttoned, the muffler was in place, and his briefcase was under his arm. No doubt the contract was in there. Robbie kissed the mother-in-law goodbye and said another private word to her. Before he left, he reminded the two men, even the little girl, to talk to no one else about the matter, especially not anybody from the insurance company. Refer all calls to them. Mort remained beside the little girl. "Make a note," Robbie said to Ivan as soon as they were in the Mercedes. Call Osmond County and find out when the coroner's inquest is. We need to be there. There's a lot riding on when the coroner fixes the time of the major infarct. If he says it was 3 days ago, then the doctor's going to claim all the damage was done, and even if he'd made the correct diagnosis yesterday, it wouldn't have saved her. Robbie gave Evan the name of a pathologist he wanted to attend the inquest with them, an expert witness who could come to an opposite conclusion from the county coroner's if need be. Favor was pensive as he drove, allaying Evan's worst fear that he might even celebrate. They were on the highway now, and the Mercedes was a placid environment. Sisters of Mercy was far out beyond the suburban sprawl. Here the frozen corn shocks of the autumn lay fallen, elbowing through the snows that filled the vast fields beside the road.
"Can I ask something?" Evan said eventually.
At her center, a storm of odd feelings was agitating. "When I met you, you said your name was pronounced Favor, like do me a favor. But just now you said fever. You say it like that most of the time."
"Fever? Favor? I answer to both. When I was going to be a star, I thought fever was better. Hotter, right? I go back and forth. Maybe I was trying to be a hit with you that first day."
He shrugged with his usual whimsical appreciation for his own deviations. Most of the people around him said fever, in fact.
"And besides," he said, "there's the public relations thing."
She didn't understand.
"The name was Faber, in the old country. It's one of those Ellis Island stories. The immigration officer couldn't understand the accent, and my grandfather tried to correct him, so F-E-A-V-E-R ended up on his papers. But you know, some people who think this way, they'll look at me, they'll think Faber. Faber. Jew. So I'm Fever. With the Rick Myers. Part of the play."
She took her time with that. Robbie smiled briefly, pleased as always to gall her.
"And what about the crying? Is that part of the play, too?"
"I guess. That's sort of our trademark, Mort and me. You know, out on the street, we compete. Every guy, every gal in this business. We all think we're the greatest trial lawyer who ever held a legal pad. We all want the work. It's greed and ego. Like with these people. This is a good case, okay? Real good. Word'll get around fast. Probably a dozen guys will have some kind of in. The aunt, or the neighborhood cop, or their minister. And all of them will come beat on the Rick Myers door to say they know lawyers better than Fever and Dinnerstein. I'm gonna have to stick closer to these people than the label on their shirts for at least 3 weeks just to deal with that. But anyway, when these other lawyers put the knock on us, they'll ask, 'Did they cry for you?' You know? Like that's our trick. Did they sit up and fetch?"
"But is it?"
"What?"
"A trick. Can you just do that?"
He asked her to hold the wheel and pressed his hand to his nose. He might have been meditating. When he finally faced her, beads of quicksilver brimmed in both eyes. He blinked, sending the tears down each cheek, but his grim expression gave way at once to a sly smile.
"I'm good," he told her as he resumed the wheel.
She watched him easing back into the gray leather, his cheeks still moist from his dramatics, while he luxuriated in the shock he inevitably inspired. He found her contempt so reliable, she realized. And with that, some premonition broke through the inner commotion. Was she being played?
"And you can just tell yourself to cry? The way I tell myself to open and close my fist?"
"Not exactly. I think about stuff."
"What stuff?"
"Sad stuff."
"Well, what kind of sad stuff did you think about now?"
He gave his chin a querulous little shake. He wasn't saying.
"I told you about the Olympics."
"It's different," he said. "That's like a fact. And besides, I guessed."
"And I admitted it," she said, adding, "like a fool."
He glanced over, apparently seeking to determine whether the self-rebuke was sincere. She stiffened her face a bit for his benefit. They drove on a mile, the only sound the unnerving hum of the tires on the cold road.
"The girl,"
he said suddenly.
"What?"
"I was thinking about that little girl. I was thinking about what it's going to be like for her tomorrow morning, when she wakes up, when her eyes spring open and she's thinking something dopey about school or the movies or something she dreamt. And then, like an arrow right through the heart, she's going to realize that she lost her mother. And she's just going to fall down and down into fear, horrible fear, because she's smart. And she'll know she can't even figure out yet how huge and horrible this is." That's what I was thinking.
"So it's not a play. The crying?"
"Huh?"
She repeated herself.
"I thought I explained this to you," he said, "about the play."
Irritated, he revolved his head between the road and Even.
"Don't you see this whole thing? What am I doing at that hospital? Or a funeral home? Or any place else I go to pick up business? I say to these people, 'Hey, you're in pain. Terrible pain, but I can make it better. Trust me, I hurt for you. I'll get you money. I'll calm your outrage.' But it's a play. Remember Chaos and Darkness? I'd need the power to raise the dead before I could really do anything for that little girl, right? The money'll be nice, but hey."
"So you don't care?"
"What? You think I stay up four nights in a row when I'm on trial because I don't care?"
Staring at her, he was suddenly paying no attention to the highway at all. He directed the Mercedes into a small wayside where the picnic tables had been turned over so they would not be crushed by the snow load. The brown legs, cross-membered, looked like arms waving for someone's attention.
"Is that really what you think?"
She was afraid to answer. In ire, his eyes had darkened. He was going to spout again, speechify. And she didn't mind. She was glad, actually. Except for remote moments of anger, Robbie Favor could rarely be motivated to be fully sincere. But now something elevated was transmitted into his over-orchestrated handsomeness.
"Look, I love the spotlight. I dig the bucks. I adore getting the chance to strut around on my victory lap down Marshall Avenue whenever I win a case. But hell," he said, "you actually think I drop to these judges just for myself? Get real. I can't bear to come back to these people and say I lost. You lost. Fuck hope. It's only pain, and it's only going to get worse. I can't do that. That's why it's a play. They need it, and I need it."
Carried away, he had briefly taken hold of her hands. She did not know if he drew back then because he had woken to the precariousness of that gesture, or simply in refuge from what must have flooded from her eyes. He touched his bright muffler and softly said one more thing before he again put the Mercedes in gear.
"It's a play."
Chapter 14. A few days later, as Robbie and Even were about to leave for the night, McManus called. Amari had followed Rollo Kosick to Robbie's old hangout, an upscale spot called Attitude. After a hurried stop downstairs for their equipment, Even and Robbie buffeted through the after-work crowd, the walks illuminated by the autos gridlocked in the avenues. Favor was surprisingly chipper. His apprehensions about Kosick seemed momentarily eased by the prospect of returning to the place where many good evenings had been spent until about a year ago, when Rainey's debility was no longer impending doom, but a calamity that had arrived. Attitude's long windows fronted Cahill Street, but the bar was entered through the lobby of a fancy retail arcade, where headless mannequins posed elegantly in the windows.
Dr. Goodbody's, the health club at which Robbie had formerly exercised every evening, was also here in the basement. He said that the serious fitness types remained in the cellar after their workouts, sipping carrot juice and eating soy burgers. The crowd that hurried up to Attitude was more to his liking. They went to step classes, played racquetball and tennis, lifted weights for an hour, then stopped in here for tequila and cigarettes to see if their strict physical regimen could yield any benefits more immediate than good health. A stylish black sign hung over the doorway, and the decor within was sleek. Granite tables and polished chrome railings, Italian fixtures in the shape of inverted calla lilies casting a low light. The crowd was all suits. Some prowled the tumbling scene around the bar, a long arc of granite and wood. Others were settled in for the evening at the narrow tables in the slate loft, suspended overhead amid the smoke. A chorus rose up as soon as Robbie came through the revolving door. "Hey, ambulance chaser!" a man yelled, and arrived through the bustle to embrace him. He was a beefier version of Favor, dark, elegantly dressed, with shining black hair moosed back into a bullet-shaped do.
"Where you been, for Christ's sake? You hanging out at the rehab hospital, trying to get the nurses to pass out your card to all the quads? I'm waiting for this guy to get a toll-free number, 1-800-PARALYZED.
This was Doyle Mersing, a commercial real estate agent. He put an arm around Even as he was shaking her hand.
"Come on, have a pop," said Doyle.
There were two women beside the stool he'd briefly vacated, one in her late 30s, the other slightly older, both with big hair and bright manicures, both smoking cigarettes and pleasantly drunk. Divorcees, Even guessed. Neither wore a wedding ring, and there was something beaten down beneath their good cheer. Even watched as one of them, Sylvia, darker and thinner than her companion, began focusing on Robbie. It seemed astonishingly predictable, like something in nature, a flower turning toward the sun. Sylvia began asking him questions and tossed her hair back from her face so she could give him her full attention. At Robbie's wisecracks, Sylvia and her friend rattled in delight. After one of these explosions, Even noticed that Sylvia had laid her hand on Robbie's arm, apparently regarding Even as no impediment. Turning away, Even lifted her face to the smoke, the music, and laughing, the smug but desperate emanations that lingered like fumes in Attitude's atmosphere. She had never been much at ease in this kind of place. They could have used a plastic surgeon and an erector set to make her over at Elizabeth Arden, and she'd still never count for much here. Even pretending to be someone else, she couldn't project the air of frank and fearless interest that wafted off the Sylvias of the world. How did they do that? To Even, it remained an enduring mystery. The bartender, Lutice, was a gorgeous black woman with strong features and perfect makeup, including dramatic shadings around the eyes. She was nearly 6 feet tall and in beautiful shape. She had yellow nails the length of talons. Lutice was a fortune-teller by profession, Robbie told Even. She took that at first for a joke.
"Speaks the truth," said Lutice. "Happens every now and then. You better keep your eye on this boy around this place," she warned Even. "He's got more lines than a zebra."
Robbie laughed, but Lutice wouldn't let up.
"Watch him, I'm telling you. He's like a snake. Strike anything that moves."
"I'm a one-man menagerie."
"Pot jackass, too."
Mersing, who'd gone off for cigarettes, beat the pack on the heel of his palm as he returned to his stool.
"So what's going on in here?" Robbie asked.
Despite the din, Even could hear Robbie clearly in the earpiece. The way the instrument imposed Favor's voice on the hubbub was slightly disconcerting. Klecker had applied the Foxbite units to Favor's thigh hurriedly, complaining about the idea of recording in a crowded saloon.
"Way too much ambient sound. You get glasses clinking, other people's conversations. The defendant always ends up claiming that the guy saying, "I did it," was sitting at another table.
Robbie remained adamant that his only chance with Kosick was here after Rollo had had a couple of belts. For the moment, however, Faber seemed in no hurry to search for him.
"Same old," Mersing answered. "Your friend, the one they used to call SBD, she's been coming in again."
"Oh, yeah?
Tell her I say howdy."
Robbie tilted his glass back and watched the bubbles rise.
"SBD," he said softly and smiled.
"Short black dress," Mersing explained when Sylvia asked. Robbie and he then conversed about a fellow named Connerty. He'd had 3 marriages, which, all told, had not lasted a year. Currently, he was seeing someone whom Mersing referred to as the Sicilian girl.
"Glows in the dark," Robbie said.
"Really?" The two men shared a laugh. Sylvia was fully entwined with Robbie now. Her arm was wrapped around his, and she'd drawn him close as she sat on the polished steel bar stool. Her knees, on which her nylons shone, were parted vaguely, and Favor's hip occupied the resulting space. A huge swell of laughter rippled through Mersing and Robbie and the two women. Even had missed the joke. Looking away again, from nowhere, she felt herself nearly knocked flat by longing. It arrived something like her period, always a little surprising and unwanted, with such sudden focused intensity that for a single instant she was afraid she might even cry out. And then, blessedly, as ever, it passed, leaving her in the aftermath still throbbing like a bell after an alarm. The thought of a real drink instead of her Perrier lime tempted her briefly. But Faber suddenly shed Sylvia. He'd spotted Kosick. He left a large tip for Lutis before motioning even onward. Robbie had said Kosick looked like an anchovy fresh out of the can, and with that description, even had no trouble spotting him. A stringy, sallow, silent man who sat at the end of the bar. Just above him, a pianist played show tunes in the loft. Rollo was alone. He was always alone, according to what Robbie had said. If somebody sat down beside Rollo, he moved to the next stool, and if there were no stools left, he just stared at the wall or the bottles on the bar in front of him. He generally spoke only to Lutis or the other bartenders. He was genial with them, if you could call the exchange of a few words geniality. He laid 2 20s down when he assumed his stool, and quit when there was only a 10, which he left as a tip. As they came upon him now, Kosick had stolen a look at himself in the bar mirror and was patting his thinning hair back into place.
"Rollo the K! How's tricks?" Robbie slipped into the usual open space beside Kosick.
Rollo nodded a bit and worked on his cigarette. Up above, the pianist began a rendition of Yesterday. Dressed entirely in black, the musician crooned along lethargically, bearing up through one more night of indignity in which any attention he received came only when the patrons reached an awkward juncture in their come-ons. Even knew the music was going to be a problem on the recording, but there was nothing to do about it now. Kosick had yet to say a word anyway. When Robbie introduced her, Rollo cranked his face over his shoulder and looked her up and down in far too frank a manner. He was out of place in here, where the air throbbed with pretense and fashion. He wore a very old tweed sport coat and a washed-out plaid shirt. His black hair, the soggy remnants of an old DA, spilled over his collar. His face looked dried out by drink. Robbie motioned to the piano bar up above and told Kosick a quick joke. A guy comes into a joint, opens his briefcase, and on the bar puts down a miniature Steinway and a little man 1 foot tall. The little man plays for an hour, and the guy collects a number of tips. When the barkeep expresses his admiration, the man with the briefcase grimaces. "Whoever heard of a genie with a hearing problem?"
You really think I asked for a 12-inch penis?
Rollo took it the way he might have tried to shake off a punch, twitching out the sour leavings of a smile. He crushed his cigarette and shook his head. He drank old fashions and kept his right hand on his glass most of the time, his index finger curled inward. Robbie had explained that the nail had a sinister look, a little like the shell of a rotting walnut. It had been crushed in the service while Rollo was hauling an artillery round. It grew back black and wrinkled and was ordinarily hidden. Favor said that was the only way to tell when Rollo was angry, since he otherwise maintained a morbid and haunting lack of affect. But when he extended that index finger at you, with that ugly token at the end, it was not a good sign. At the moment, Kosick took the stem of his cherry between his thumb and third finger. He gave it a twirl, then knocked the glass back, draining it and taking one of the ice cubes in his mouth. He chewed on it as Robbie and Evan stood beside him in silence. When Lutice came their way, Robbie put a 50 on the bar and surrendered his stool to Evan, asking Lutice to refill Rollo and to tell Evan her fortune. She and Robbie, even Kosick, watched while Lutice shuffled and smoothly dealt out the tarot cards, despite the glistening obstruction of her yellow nails, each curved like a parrot's bill.
Home?
She heard Kosick ask Robbie very softly, apparently thinking Evan was distracted. His voice was high, a virtual countertenor. She wondered if its feminine quality accounted for his reluctance to speak.
Not good, Robbie answered. Kosick grunted.
It was not clear if that was a response to Lorraine's condition or to the fact that Lutice had just put down his drink.
Listen, Robbie said to Kosick, I'm happy to bump into you. I got a little something. I've been trying to figure out who to talk to. Maybe you can give me a pointer. You don't mind listening, right? It's a bar room. Everybody's got to tell you their problems.
Robbie laughed. When Evan's eyes drifted sideways, she saw Kosick toss another ice cube into his mouth.
Anyway, I got some problems in a case I filed a couple weeks back. Robbie named it.
Who'd you draw?
Kosick asked neutrally. There was no way to tell if he truly didn't recall.
Malatesta.
Good judge, said Kosick, then added, knows the law.
Lutice continued dealing on the granite bar top, talking to the figures of the cards as if they could hear her.
Right. Evan heard Robbie say in her earpiece. Normally, you know, I'm really happy to get him. But I got a very big problem. Case is a structural work act. Clients painting an atrium and as scaffolding collapses. Serious, serious back injuries. Herniations, L4 and 5. So I call to tell him we filed, they always want to know, and he says, I'm a little numb. I just saw my internist and I've got stage 4 cancer of the lung. Cancer! Now I got a hellacious problem. Case is worth zip if the insurer finds out he's a goner, right? No loss of future earnings.
With considerable circumspection, Robbie detailed his troubles in having the case before Malatesta. For Robbie to have any hope of recovering much, the judge would have to quickly suspend the discovery process while Robbie attempted to settle. But Malatesta never agreed to stay discovery, a practice only Judge Skolnick ordinarily allowed. Walter's warning made it certain that Malatesta would not consider a deviation in this case.
So I got a bellyful on this one, Robbie told Kosick.
Robbie, as usual, had laid down the pitch just as Sennett and McManus had scripted it. He wasn't asking for relief so much as issuing a warning. Everybody would end up a loser if the case remained before Malatesta. As he spoke, Robbie concentrated on the TV over the bar where mud bikes were spinning through glop. Evan was pretending to watch the piano. Looking back, she saw Kosick's small eyes aimed at Favor. A pure, deadly light beamed from them.
He was flicking nervously at the notch over his lip, touching it again and again with his blackened fingernail. He said absolutely nothing. Taking the cue, Robbie shifted at once to talk of the Indiana basketball team, which had clobbered the Hands, the U's team, last week. Kosick showed no interest. He got off his stool and threw back the diluted remains of his drink. Lutice, at that moment, laid out the last of the cards, a red queen, and stared down at it. When her wide brown eyes rose to even, they held a look of alarm. "The two-faced queen lives a lie," she said. It was not clear Kosick had heard that as he pushed out with no word of goodbye. The recording was terrible. At the critical moments, Robbie, just as Klecker had instructed, had rounded his shoulders and hunched forward to funnel sound toward the mic, which tonight had been placed under his tie. But the piano and the singing intruded into every sentence. It was as if Robbie were speaking between measures in a karaoke bar. A woman, to whom even had paid no attention, could be heard distinctly now, whining along. "Now I long for yesterday." The recording offered no proof Kosick had even heard Robbie. But he had. Even had been palpably frightened by the wave of primal menace he transmitted, as had Robbie. Sennett and I had hurried to McManus's conference room to hear the results, and Favor now directed his attention to Stan. "They're going to make me dead," he told him, "if I keep pushing like this. I said way too much." Sennett frowned. "Listen, Stan," said Robbie, "you may think I'm just afraid of the big bad wolf, but Brendan's the only guy I know who's an actual killer. I mean, killed with his bare hands in Korea, and would do it again today if he thought he had to. He's ordered hits. I mean it. That's why he's stayed hooked up. It's not just for the money. He wants to be able to push a button on somebody if he has to." Even I had trouble believing that. Most talk of violence, even in mob cases, was gas, and I had a hard time imagining a presiding judge orchestrating a murder. Robbie looked around the table, where he was encountering similarly skeptical expressions from Alf and Jim and Joe Amari. As McManus had told him long ago, CIs were always scared by what they were doing. "Here, I'll tell you a story," Robbie said, looking about to each of us. "I've told you before that Brendan's had the same thing on the side now for more than 20 years, with Constanza in his office. Constanza is like a jewel, this tiny, exquisite thing, 5 feet tall, perfectly shaped, and this noble Mexican face, Irish features and Indian cheekbones. 50 plus now, and still this very quiet, dignified beauty. Married lady, which is another story. With 2 kids, a boy, never meant for much good, and a daughter, completely the opposite. And Brendan, you know, he's been good to these kids, like he's been to me, frankly, always looking out and concerned. Anyway, the daughter goes off to the U with a full boat ride and does the college-age breaking-away stuff, takes up with a boyfriend, black kid. And not a bad kid, really. Full of himself, but hell, he's 19 years old. Constanza was having none of it. Not just because he's black. I think if he was black and Catholic, she maybe could handle it. But that's a twofer with her. And the daughter, of course, she kicked and moaned originally, but eventually, you know, she loves her mom. Life goes on. She adioses the black guy and meets a nice boy, Puerto Rican, which is next worst to mom. But this one's been in the seminary, so he otherwise fills the bill. Only this black kid, Artis, he won't take no for an answer. He calls. He follows the daughter around. He won't back off. And his life is going to hell in the process. He drops out of school. He gets strung out on something. He's more and more desperate, and finally one night he's dusted his brains out. He jumps the daughter and the PR boyfriend. He pistol whips the Rican. Holds the girl at gunpoint, threatens to rape her, and finally, for whatever kind of jolly this is,
makes her watch while he pulls his own pud.
Well, Constanza goes straight to Brendan. Now, Brendan, when it comes to power, Brendan gets every channel. So he's never let go of his alliances on the force. If he gives the call, he can have 30 uniformed coppers looking for this kid. He can make sure Artis doesn't get bail, that he gets the treatment at the jail till his anal sphincter has the same consistency as cream of wheat. But that's not good enough, because Brendan, I guess, personally told this kid on a couple occasions, cut it out or else. So now it's or else. He gets on the phone. He calls Toots Nuccio, who was always his connect. And Brendan's Brendan. He doesn't ask for anything out loud. He just shoots the breeze with Toots. He tells Toots this story in passing about this horrible thing that happened to his secretary, Constanza, and her family. Can you believe this gorilla son of a bitch? What zoo'd they let him out of? It's a shame to call yourself a human being with the likes of that walking around on the same planet. They can't stand to breathe the same air. That's all. T-H-E end for Artis. Ciao, au revoir, sayonara, bye-bye. When they found him, he had battery acid dumped on his genitals sometime before they finished him off. And it goes on the police blotter as a gang hit. Pity what they do to each other. And here's why Brendan's a genius. Because he made sure everybody close to him knew the story. His fingerprints aren't anywhere on the hit, of course. But he tells the tale about poor Artis and smiles. Makes you think there's a God in heaven. But he was trying to make a different kind of believer. So Uncle Brendan, he ever finds out I set him up, it'll be the same for me if he gets the chance. He'll have them gut me like a fish and come by to watch my heart beat its last on the pier. As it turned out, no more than a week later, Judge Gillian Sullivan, still under relentless press criticism for her insobriety, took a 90-day administrative leave from the bench. Officially, she was hospitalized for stress. In the interval, much of her docket was reassigned. The two contrived cases Robbie'd had languishing on her call were both transferred, one to Judge Crowthers, one to Judge Barnett Skolnick. In the course of that reshuffling, the suit of the painter who developed cancer was also sent to Judge Skolnick from Judge Malatesta. The only explanation on the order was reassigned for the convenience of the court. Kosick, whatever his suspicions, had done just as Robbie had asked. But we did not know that night. What we knew was only what Robbie, with his skills at impressing himself, meant to convey. These were dangerous men. Anyone who crossed them was in peril. Afterwards, in the Mercedes, the shadows of fright and disappointment kept them silent for quite some time as Robbie maneuvered through the dwindling traffic in the dark streets. At a stoplight, they were caught under the flickerings of a mercury lamp going bad. It reminded even of a question. Glows in the dark. Implants, he answered, smiling wearily. She laughed, but there was no admiration in it. She made a remark about men. Hey, he said, you think the women in there are better? They're looking for rich guys and a free ride. It's so angry, that kind of talk. They're all angry, most of them. Because they're lonely and setting themselves up to feel worse by the time the evening is through. And they know it. Every one of them. The guys, the gals. They're lonely in their burnouts. They know they're taking what they can get. If I was going to rename that place, I'd call it Sadder But Wiser. So why did you like to go? You're telling me you've never hung out in joints like that?
Not like that. Not that she hadn't had her nights, her sorties to secret places. After the Olympics, after her body stopped being such a holy shrine, she'd go out to get juiced so she could see what she'd been missing.
She'd been part of the good time group getting smashed on Friday nights in agent hangs across the nation.
and there were evenings of abandoned, obliviated drinking, aimed really at nothing more than getting ready to have sex. But none of it lasted. For her, these evenings were at best mistakes, at worst, harshly struck notes of personal shame. And she remembered none of it with Robbie's wistfulness. Far from sad, he'd ignited the minute they were through the door. When she repeated that observation, he seesawed his head, something short of a denial. Well, I was always chasing the myth, like everybody else in there, you know. The myth of love, right? Love will make me different. Love will make me better. Love will make me dig myself. But it doesn't work, she said. It was the first thing she'd said for herself. Naturally, he didn't notice she wasn't speaking about him. At the time, romancing, getting there, it worked. In the sack, it worked. A lot. Because I was really there, and she was really there. The whole experience is beyond bullshit, right? It's beyond everything else in my life I've fucked up. I don't have a past or a law practice or a sick wife at home. And neither does she. I can be happy, and so can she. We can make each other happy. I can be something great and good to her, and she can be that way to me. And for an hour or a night, for a while, man, we can love each other for it. You know, sometimes I just sort of wake to it. Like, here I am sharing this experience, intimacy. I mean, close this way, always, to a person I didn't even know existed 6 hours ago. And I'd ask myself, is this so bad? Is this really so goddamn wrong? For me, you know, I'm not one of these guys who thinks sex is the only thing in life, but it was glorious. That's all. Glorious. He spelled it. That's how I'd think of the word. He'd gotten caught up and looked across.